Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Other than contracting the COVID-19 virus and getting sick or worse, one of the biggest worries for many Pennsylvanians is paying their medical bills if they do become ill. Many still have questions. To answer our insurance questions today is Pennsylvania Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman. Commissioner Altman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me back, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, we encourage you to give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Commissioner, the last time we spoke was right after the pandemic was being felt here in Pennsylvania. What insurance issues have come up since then, since the beginning? What questions are being asked most often?
I will tell you, Scott, I mean, we're getting questions across the board on all types of insurance. Certainly, I think the one, as you can understand, that is at top of mind for most people right now is health insurance. How can they feel secure with the health insurance they have? What can they do if they lost their health insurance? And I know we talked a lot about that exact issue when I was on with you last time. We're also starting to see a lot of steps that automobile insurers are taking, given that folks are not on the road and we're kind of in this new normal, and that impacts driving. And when it impacts driving, it impacts your insurance. And then fielding a lot of questions from businesses about their insurance coverage, like workers' compensation. So really across the board, I think insurance is really in every element of our society in ways you think about and in ways you don't think about. And when we have this new normal, it's going to impact insurance in all sorts of ways.
Have you seen a trend in any one area or in more than one areas?
You know, generally speaking, our call volume is actually about normal. But in talking to the team, I think we're getting, you know, more coronavirus-related questions, inquiries, complaints, and less of kind of your traditional things. I mean, we're seeing less car accidents because less people are driving, right? So we're getting less calls about people asking questions about claims for their car insurance. So I think the trend is just generally more questions about coronavirus.
All right. So I will ask some of the basic questions that we may have discussed in the past, but with new audience, people pay more attention since the pandemic has ramped up since the last time we spoke. How does someone know if their insurance will cover testing and treatment for COVID-19?
That's a great question. So if you have comprehensive medical insurance, that's it, coverage your employer is providing for you, if you bought coverage on the Affordable Care Act marketplace, the essential health benefits package that all of those plans are covering includes hospitalization, treatment, general lab testing, all of the things that coronavirus testing and treatment falls into. So generally, we're going to have coverage there. But there are a couple new things that are also really important. The Federal CARES Act, which is one of the bills that Congress has passed in response to coronavirus, is requiring insurance companies to waive any cost sharing associated with testing for COVID-19. So if you have one of those comprehensive medical plans, you should not see cost sharing for testing. And that's not just for the test itself. That's also for I have to go to the doctor's office or the urgent care to receive that test, and there are facility costs associated like that. But we're also seeing a lot of health insurers kind of stepping up during this time. Many of ours, actually all of ours in Pennsylvania, had waived cost sharing for testing even before that federal legislation came into place. But many of them, and most in the Commonwealth, are also waiving cost sharing associated with treatment. So not just are they covering treatment, but they're not going to charge you your deductible, your copayment, et cetera. So I would definitely encourage Pennsylvanians to contact their health insurer, ask questions if you have them, double check how things work. But also, you know, to feel confident that if you have major medical health insurance, you're going to, generally speaking, have coverage. And we're here to help you if you have questions.
You go ahead.
I was just going to say there are some people who, particularly in recent years, have chosen types of insurance products to cover their healthcare needs that are not technically health insurance. We call them limited benefit plans, accepted benefit plans, and we've talked about this before, Scott. They come with a lower price tag, and that makes them appealing to people, but they come with a lower price tag for a reason. And so if you have one of those types of plans, and we can certainly talk about it more, I would all really encourage you to contact that insurance plan, make sure you understand what they are going to do and not do. Unfortunately, those plans, generally speaking, come with a lot of limitations and frankly, a lot of traps that policyholders can fall into from a coverage perspective.
That was definitely one of the questions I had about those limited plans. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but I do want to backtrack for just a moment. When you refer to cost sharing, I think you've answered this question, but when you refer to cost sharing, you're talking about copays and deductibles?
Yep. And then the third general one is coinsurance. So all of those things that you kind of have to pay when you have insurance, when you seek care. So the portion your insurance doesn't cover, the cost sharing is a blanket term for all of them. Mm.
So now let's get to those short-term policies. I don't know if they even are referred to as policies that you referred to. Last year, the Trump administration came up with this plan. They were supposed to be low cost. But I remember at the time you saying that you warned a lot of people that this would not cover a lot. Do you know whether they are covering testing treatment for COVID-19?
I do not know. I have not seen kind of a lot about that right now. We haven't gotten inquiries or complaints from consumers that I'm aware of. I'd want to double check that, but I'm pretty well aware of the coronavirus issues that we're seeing right now. So I do believe we have not seen complaints, but it's something I'm worried about. We did, issue a notice to all insurers that cover health some time ago, setting expectations, asking them to take flexibilities in the best interest of their policyholders. And, you know, we issued a clarifying notice last week saying, hey, if you're one of these limited benefit plans, you are not off the hook. And we also expect you to take additional steps, provide flexibilities, and also for those that may be selling insurance right now as people are potentially losing employer-based coverage, we're going to really be watching to make sure that you're being honest about people's options, honest about some of the downsides of this coverage during this time, and that they're being sold fairly in the Commonwealth. But when I say we're asking for flexibilities and certain steps like waiving cost sharing for testing, it's important to remember that with one of these plans, your starting point is very different than if you have comprehensive coverage. And so you're being flexible, but from a place of already just so much less coverage than you would see otherwise. And we'll have to kind of learn what that means in practice, unfortunately.
One of the questions that I've heard often, even in the past week or so, is if you are uninsured, can you get a test?
Yes. So absolutely. And first of all, no Pennsylvanian should forego seeking treatment, asking questions, getting the test because of fear of the cost. And if you have questions about that, if you want to talk about that, sort of before you actually go seek care, I recommend you contact our Department of Health, their hotline, who are helping people, providers with coronavirus questions and issues every day at 877-PA-HEALTH. But beyond that, we have seen the Trump administration and Congress, with some of the dollars they've passed, commit to providing coverage to the uninsured for coronavirus, and particularly for covering the cost of testing. So we know that commitment is out there. What we have not seen, and what I would certainly like to see and think we need to see soon to have that certainty, is guidance from the federal government on how that is all going to work in practice, how those dollars are going to flow to Pennsylvania's hospitals to make sure they are not left on the hook, et cetera. So that commitment is there, but we just don't have the details yet. And I'm hopeful that the Trump administration knows how important it is to get that information out, and we'll be sharing it soon.
One caveat that I have heard, though, is that someone should, even if they're uninsured, and as you just explained, they can get a test, but they just shouldn't show up to get a test. They need a consultation with a doctor first. So say they do that. They call a doctor. Now, I don't know whether they would be seen in person, or just, they go through a checklist of questions before going to testing. But is that covered?
Scott, Generally speaking, because what we're seeing in the federal language is when you talk about testing, you're also talking about costs associated with testing. But these are the critical questions that we need the federal government to be answering. But in the meantime, I don't want consumers or anyone who's having symptoms to feel frustrated by that answer. And I just want to reiterate that we, the Commonwealth, are here to help, that no one should forgo testing and treatment, and contact the Department of Health, or if you contact my office, we will get you to the right place and help you figure out how to get the care you need, given the concerns that you have.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman, answering your insurance-related questions, those related especially to the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. If you have a question or a comment, we'll have the commissioner on for about another 12 minutes or so, work your phone calls in now if you can. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Lenny in York. Lenny, you're on the air.
Hi. I have an alternative faith-based healthcare plan called MediShare, and I've had it for the past 4 years. And I had the opportunity to test their performance when my wife had a surgery this past fall. They paid all of their roughly $30,000 obligation, and I pay a fraction of what I would pay for an Affordable Care Act plan. And I just wanted to mention that to people who are looking for cheaper alternatives. I know they do not have a legal obligation to pay their claims, but they did in my case.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Commissioner, what about that?
Yeah, so we have seen, these, we call them healthcare sharing ministries, is the technical term, and we've seen some more of them in recent years as well. Just to clarify, they are not insurance. They are not legally considered insurance. They are not, therefore, within my regulatory purview, but they are generally affiliated with a church or a specific faith and offer coverage where sort of a group of individuals share in the medical costs of one another. We have seen, and there have been some kind of actions taken nationally, some of these sharing ministries are, really take that faith-based perspective to heart, and they do the right thing, and I'm really glad to hear that that was done in this case. But there are some, and we have seen and heard of cases where that's not true. And so, since that's out of my regulatory purview, and actually it's really out of anyone's regulatory purview, they offer, in the separation of church and state, they're on the church side, not the state side. It's just important to ask a lot of questions and perhaps hear from folks like that caller who can tell, what their actual experience has been when they've needed help paying for medical care.
We have a question from a listener who says, it's actually an insurance broker, says, we hear several large auto insurance companies offering rebates on their premiums. I thought we as licensed agents are not allowed to rebate in our course of business. Do insurance companies have different rules?
Thanks for that question. Quite a technical one for the radio. So we do not allow rebates. And generally speaking, I think this gets down to terminology. All of the insurers who are giving money back, and we do have many large insurers and some small ones in the Commonwealth who are giving money back, have done so in a way that they have filed with the department, and we have approved for them to do so. That may be through an endorsement to their policy in effect. So while they may be using the term rebate to their customers because that's what they understand, and for one of those customers, all you kind of need to know is you are going to be getting money back or potentially credits to future premium payments, depending on how it's structured. But for the agent with their technical question, the way it is being done is not considered a quote-unquote rebate for those purposes.
I'm curious because under normal circumstances, premiums are set, have to be approved by the insurance department. What about in a case like this? I mean, it's great that so many insurance carriers are offering rebates or offering, credits for their automobile insurance policies, but do you have to approve them, meaning the insurance department, do you have to approve them, or is the consumer relying on what the insurance company is telling them of how much they can rebate or give credit?
Nope. We, as I said, we do still approve them. They're all coming through our office. And, you know, in addition, I said before, you know, we've sort of put forth expectations to health insurance companies about how we expect them to step up during this crisis. We've done the same for auto insurers, and many are doing a collective group of things that may include giving money back. There are also many are not canceling policies if people are unable to pay their premiums right now. They're providing other ways, longer-term payment plans, et cetera, for individuals that may be temporarily struggling with income. They're stepping up and providing coverage in situations that under a normal course of business, they wouldn't provide coverage, like delivery of goods. That's normally considered a business activity, not a personal one, and your personal auto insurance doesn't cover it. Many are now because they know people are using their personal vehicles to deliver food, to deliver pharmaceuticals, et cetera. So it's a collection of things that we're seeing insurers do on the auto side to be flexible. But once again, if it has to do with rates, if it's about lowering costs or giving money back, that is also being approved by the department. But we're working very, very quickly because we, of course, don't want to be the barrier to any Pennsylvanian not getting money in their pocket that they could have in their pocket.
Are there any that you have said no to or said that, okay, you could, that's not enough, or you disagree with the amount that they were, that the company was offering?
I don't believe so yet. I would want to check with the team officially. There have been some where we've kind of talked about how they're planning to structure it to make sure it's structured fairly and correctly under our laws. You know, it's very difficult. In terms of an amount, we're all operating in real time, and there's a lot of uncertainty, as everyone knows, with many things about the crisis and kind of the overall impact on the auto market, on claims frequency, the things that are going to impact pricing. We don't know all of those answers yet, and so I think we are in the point of trying to expedite money going into people's pockets while we learn kind of holistically what actually occurred and is occurring in response to the crisis.
Let's take a phone call from Rhonda in Chambersburg. Rhonda, you're on the air.
My question is, I have Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield. I had the test done, and it was over $1,000. And I still have to pay my copay, which is almost $500, that I have to pay out of pocket. I was under the assumption that it would be no cost to us.
Insurance Commissioner Altman, what about that?
Thanks so much for that question, Rhonda. I'm surprised and concerned to hear that. Do we still have Rhonda on the
yes,
line?
Yes.
Rhonda, when did you receive that test?
March
18th. Is that what you just said?
Yes.
Okay. Well, maybe lucky for you, March 18th is actually the day that the law that requires testing to be covered without cost sharing went into effect. It may actually be in your case that while the law went into effect that day, your insurer hadn't made their system changes. So I would certainly encourage you to call your insurer, but I would also offer to you that this is one of the things my department does, is help people who are having trouble with their claims. And if you'd like help kind of walking you through that, helping contact your insurer, you can feel free to contact my office at 877-881-6388. That's our consumer hotline, but that really doesn't sound right. And let me just tell any listener, you know, if you are in a situation like that where you're hearing from people like me on the radio, that your cost sharing should be waived and you get a bill, ask questions because it very well may not be right. Don't just assume that's you know, a bill that you should be getting, and reach out and call us if you need us.
And Rhonda, if you didn't get that number, we have it on our website, WITF.org, under Smart Talk. But thanks for your call, and I'm sure there are other people who will have questions that are very similar to Rhonda's. So thank you very much for that call. You know, I'm curious about this, Commissioner Altman, and I don't know whether you're even in a position to answer this, but maybe anecdotally, has there been an uptick in life insurance policies that have been purchased?
You know, we are hearing that and seeing that, and kind of from the life insurers in our market, you know, talking about that. It's very common that at times when people are thinking about things like coronavirus being the number of deaths in the state or the country or the world kind of on the news every day, that you are starting to think about your own financial planning, how you prepare if something like that were to happen to you or a loved one. And so we actually do, it is pretty common to see upticks in life insurance interest, uptick in life insurance sales at times like this when people are just simply focused and thinking about those questions.
I know you can't sit here and provide advice to everyone, but what kind of life insurance policies or questions should someone ask if they don't have life insurance and they think, well, now's a good time to look into it?
Yeah, I mean, just generally speaking, yeah, I cannot offer financial advice, and I would always encourage anyone considering financial planning. Life insurance is, of course, one thing on a menu of different financial planning options that should be considered, and it's important to seek advice from reputable sources, trusted loved ones or friends, or licensed professionals who can help walk you through that option and figure out really with your financial situation, your savings, your income, your anticipated income, how much longer you're planning to work, what might best fit your needs for what you're able to invest now and what you'd like to see supporting either yourself, for example, in retirement, or your family if something unfortunate were to happen. So my advice is just seek information. We have lots of information about all types of insurance products, including life insurance, on our website, which is a good place to start, insurance.pa.gov.
We really even haven't even mentioned Medicaid, and we should, because this is something that a lot of people count on medical assistance, Medicaid, to pay their health care bills. How has Medicaid been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic?
Sure. So Medicaid is within the Department of Human Services, so I'll speak to it at a high level, but certainly would also encourage you, I'm sure you have, but bringing Secretary Miller to give some more details, not just on Medicaid, but also the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, and the other important programs that DHS offers that provide food support and other types of support during challenging times. We are anticipating that we will see more people enrolling in the Medicaid program, more children enrolling in the CHIP program, and also more people enrolling in the marketplace, which we've also talked about a lot, Scott. And Medicaid has taken steps to try and be more flexible, try to, expedite people's enrollment process in anticipation of that increase. But I actually haven't seen, I don't have sort of data in front of me on whether we've seen that uptick take place yet. Last I heard, the answer was no, and my guess is not, because while we are seeing people losing, unfortunately, employment, in many cases, for example, an employer may have paid in March the premium for their health insurance in April. And so we haven't quite seen that cycle of the transitioning of health insurance coverage come into effect yet, but we are expecting it to happen.
Commissioner, we have heard so much over the past year, well, a lot longer than that, maybe when the Affordable Care Act was being debated 10 years ago. But can an insurance carrier cancel a policy if a person is diagnosed with COVID-19 as a pre-existing condition?
Absolutely not if you have major medical health insurance. Those limited, absolutely not if you have major medical health insurance. And if anyone thinks that happens, contact my office immediately. What I will say is, once again, those short-term limited benefit plans. Now, they can deny you for a pre-existing condition when you apply. We have seen cases where they deny someone after they gave you coverage for something they then determine was pre-existing. We see cases where, they deny where they exclude coverage related to a pre-existing condition. So they'll give you coverage, but they won't cover anything related to a pre-existing condition. But I am pretty hard-pressed to believe that coronavirus could be considered a pre-existing condition unless you got the plan kind of right now and you were already experiencing symptoms. So I would definitely, once again, ask questions about that, contact my office. But I want to go back and reiterate, if you have health insurance from your employer, if you have health insurance on the marketplace, if you have Medicaid, if you have Medicare, all of those major medical plans cannot drop coverage just because you get diagnosed with coronavirus or with anything else.
so many people have lost their jobs. We talked about COBRA insurance the last time you were on the program, but so many people have lost their jobs and so many people have lost their insurance. What are their options?
Yeah, thank you. That is such an important question right now. And we do have a lot of information on our website, insurance.ca.gov again, for people in that situation, as well as kind of mixed into some of the resources on other state agency websites. Generally speaking, there are three things that you should consider. The first is COBRA. COBRA allows you to maintain the coverage that you already had through your employer. But unfortunately, with COBRA, you have to pay the full cost of the premium. So when you were employed, you were probably paying a portion, and your employer was paying the remaining portion of the premium. Now, that how much each pays varies by employer. But when you are on COBRA, you pay it all yourself, and that can be quite expensive on a monthly basis. But many employer plans are quite generous in their benefits, and if you elect COBRA, you do not have to start over on your deductible with a new plan. So if you've had a lot of costs in this year already, that may be something to take into account. The other choice that Pennsylvanians have, depending on their income, will either be Medicaid, which we talked about, or the Marketplace. The Marketplace, we have a lot of terms for it, also called the Exchange, also called healthcare.gov. So all of those things mean the same thing, is an open marketplace where Pennsylvanians can go and shop for private insurance coverage for themselves and their families. It is all major medical comprehensive insurance. It will all do everything we talked about today, Scott, with cost sharing and coverage for testing, coverage for treatment. For many Pennsylvanians, that coverage also comes with financial assistance. 80% of Pennsylvanians currently in that market, actually quite over 80%, receive financial assistance. All of that 80% get help paying that monthly premium, more help if you have a lower income for your household, less help if you have more. But many people also get help paying for out-of-pocket costs like copays and deductibles. So you really do have a choice if you're losing employer coverage. Do you elect COBRA? Or do you see what you're eligible for on the marketplace or Medicaid? And I would encourage anyone in that circumstance to look at both, to consider the monthly cost, to consider out-of-pocket costs like your deductible, and to consider the benefits and other things we always talk about, like which providers are in the network and which prescription drugs are on the formulary in making that decision.
And that's even though it is not an open enrollment period for the marketplace, right?
That is right. However, the marketplace has something called special enrollment periods, where if certain things change in your life, you are eligible to enroll at any time in the year. That is one of those things is loss of other comprehensive health insurance. So if you had insurance through your employer and you lose that insurance, you have 60 days to go to the marketplace no matter what time of the year and enroll in coverage. Now, what we don't have a special enrollment period for right now is if you are already uninsured, so you didn't have health insurance coverage to lose in order to qualify, or you had an insurance product that is not considered health insurance, like those short-term plans, and you want to switch. Neither of those situations will qualify you for a special enrollment period. Now, that's exactly why Governor Wolf, I think 3 or 4 weeks ago now, wrote to the federal government and said, hey, we really need you to open up a special enrollment period so that any Pennsylvanian who wants comprehensive medical coverage given this crisis can get it. Unfortunately, as of now, the Trump administration has declined to do that, and so we do not have a special enrollment period available for those individuals. But once again, if you lose your employer coverage, if you're a person who unfortunately has had their employment status change and therefore their health insurance coverage status change, you do have that choice of COBRA or the Marketplace or Medicaid, depending on your income level.
Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner Jessica Altman. Commissioner Altman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be discussing the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on emergency responders. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Pennsylvania's 14 state-owned universities could be facing a loss of $70 to $100 million as a result of losing the spring semester to the COVID-19 shutdown. The spring semester to the COVID-19 shutdown has been marked by physical classes being canceled, I should say, and many students taking classes online. The Pennsylvania state system of higher education was facing major financial challenges before the shutdown, but the situation is even more dire now. So what has to happen? Joining us is Dan Greenstein, Chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. Dr. Greenstein, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. $70 to $100 million in losses, that's a pretty big impact. But overall, what has the impact of COVID-19 had on the state system of higher education?
Thanks for having me. So the so a couple things. I would begin just by speaking quickly to the, you know, tremendous effort that has been put in by our faculty and our staff and our leadership across all of our universities to manage a shift from largely face-to-face to fully remote learning in like 10 days or 2 weeks. So that was a tremendous effort, and it has been a tremendous effort across all of higher education, and just shows what we can do, and we really put our minds to it. And there's, you know, plenty of evidence of our universities chipping in and helping their communities in all sorts of ways, creating areas where people can have broadband access for kids who need access to school materials, for example, or using facilities for surge space for hospital beds. So it's just a tremendous community effort. The fiscal impacts are definitely there. The further analysis demonstrates that with the contribution of the stimulus funding, we're probably looking at a $52 million net loss between summer sessions and the current semester. So the CARES Act certainly helps significantly, but there's still that big delta that's left.
So that $70 to $100 million is, that was before, that estimate was before the CARES Act?
Correct. And once you factor in the CARES Act and then the cost of our summer sessions, which have also moved to remote, and the elimination of on-campus programming, we reckon it's about $52 million through through the beginning of fall term 2020.
I would say that's good news, but it's still $52 million.
Yeah.
What contributed to that $52 million loss?
Well, so as with most universities across the country, the biggest hit was refunding students for room and board, which was absolutely the right thing to do. You know, as students move off campus and they go to remote learning, we can't continue to charge them for room and board. So that was that money was refunded. But there was obviously some startup cost and ensuring that we moved effectively as possible to remote forms of learning. There were, you know, incidents where we had to acquire laptops and hotspots for students who didn't have access otherwise to the internet. So there was some cost incurred there, but largely the loss of auxiliary in room and board.
Now, you know, when you first came into office as chancellor of PASHE, you were on the program, and we talked about the challenges facing the system. Many of those challenges, most of them, probably still exist. What were some of the challenges that you were facing that do still exist?
So, you know, I think the biggest issue that we face is as public funding has, you know, relatively speaking, has declined over time. Tuition has gone up, which has impacted enrollments, and enrollments are tough to get anyway in a state which is pretty crowded in the higher ed marketplace. And we were somewhat slow to respond to those changing circumstances. We're responding pretty aggressively now, and all I can say is I'm really glad that we had a year and a half of you know, pretty aggressive system redesign efforts in advance of the pandemic, because it puts in place the means to continue at an accelerated pace to evolve in response to the further financial exigencies which result. So I'm you know, we're starting with a year and a half. We have a year and a half runway, which is a good thing. Yeah.
Well, what does that redesign look like? I mean, is there something that the public hasn't seen or isn't aware of? Maybe students are, or maybe they're not. What does that redesign look like?
So I'd say the biggest things that we're looking at and actually doing, one of them is obviously leveraging our operating scale, sharing, you know, putting in place a shared services environment. You are in a, you know, in a networked world, and we're demonstrating it now with having moved to remote forms of operations, that it's not necessary for all of our 14 universities to operate every single business function by themselves. More exciting, in my view, is the opportunities that we're pursuing to ensure that students at any one university have access to the educational programming at another, which means that a university anywhere in the state can have access to a much broader, students there can have access to a much broader range of educational programs, degree programs, than they could if their university had to stand up each of those programs on their own. So we're putting in place the means of doing all those things, and that's where, you know, having a year and a half head start has been absolutely tremendous. You know, obviously we're working in a number of ways to come to terms to live into our new enrollment, and that really means reducing the size of our operational footprint, making sure that our revenues and our expenditures line up in a way they haven't in a number of years. All those things are working in tandem.
You know, it only makes sense that 14 state-owned universities that for business dealings that you would combine some of the functions and work across the 14 state-owned universities. But what about on a practical level for students? I mean, is there a situation, does it exist now, will it exist, where students at one of your universities, attending one of your universities, can take classes from another?
It is, and it, you know, we already do some of that, and we have, and by a variety of means. It's not all like online learning. I had the pleasure of speaking to a group of remote classes. I was at Lock Haven, they were at four different places around the state, and they're in some physician assistance program. And you can see them all in their rooms, and they can see each other, and they can interact with each other in real time, like it's just a big, you know, kind of a 60 or 70 person lecture. It's pretty exciting, you know. So there's a variety of opportunities that we're already exploiting that demonstrate, and of course, you know, the move to remote learning demonstrates what more we, you know, if we need to, we can really do some pretty creative things. So, you know, this is a challenge, there's no doubt about it, across higher education, but there are some unique opportunities that emerge from this moment.
Well, you just said about some unique opportunities. Do you think there will be more students who will be taking online classes, or more classes that will be offered online as a result of this, because it has worked?
So it's interesting. I think we'll see a bunch of different reactions, and it's almost impossible to predict how they're going to play out in terms of our enrollments. I think it is certain from preliminary surveys that have been done of students that people are going to be concerned about safety, as, you know, students and their families are going to be concerned about safety. So they may not be sending their students as far away as they might go otherwise, and they may rely more heavily on regional providers. I think you'll see some students who will prefer remote forms of instruction. I think you'll see some faculty who prefer remote forms, particularly in the fall, where there's likely to be some significant uncertainty about the safety and the health environment surrounding us. So I think into the 2021 academic year, I do think we're going to see changes in student behavior that we can't quite yet predict. I think the other factor, which is worth paying attention to, is that in an economic downturn, and we're certainly headed, we're in one, and it's probably going to be a, you know, reasonably lengthy one, there typically tends to be an uptick in higher education enrollments as people return to education in order to reskill and upskill. And there's a huge opportunity to serve, you know, a growing number of people who are underemployed and unemployed in the state. And so what can we do to help as a public, as the state's public universities, is a major question that sits in front of us.
I want to get back to what you had mentioned earlier, declining enrollments, and we'll also talk about funding from the state. But declining enrollments, over the past decade, only one of the state schools, Westchester, has seen an increase overall in enrollments. Why do you think that is?
Well, so this is a million-dollar question. A number of our, you know, the situation is varied. Westchester has seen an increase. I think they've been very smart in terms of their academic programming. I think they've been, you know, they've obviously, they've been managed very well. They live in a growth area
in the Westchester area. So there's a variety of factors. You know, Slippery Rock, which is in a more rural part of the state, which doesn't have a robust population growth, they have remained flat in terms of their enrollments. And so, you know, there again, I think they have been proactive in their programming in ways that have resonated well with the surrounding student population. So leadership matters, choices matter, demographics matter, price matters a lot. And the price sensitivity of the students that you're facing. So there's a variety of reasons that sort of go into the various different experiences that our universities have had. I think it provides us with interesting choices that we've been looking at now since I got here and probably before, about whether the programming that we're offering, how can we ensure that the educational programs, the degrees, and the credentials that we offer, you know, resonate best with the students and the communities that we serve, that they align to their aspirations, that they align to the career aspirations that they may have, that we're working closely with employers. All those programming considerations will factor directly into our enrollments, as will price, right? In 2010, the price gap between the Pennsylvania State System universities and the nearest competitor, whether in the private or state-related spaces, was considerably greater than it is today. So, those are all sorts of factors that we need to take into account as we move forward.
You know, there are, and, you know, even before COVID-19, the pandemic, there was some speculation when we were talking about the redesign, what could be done. I know you mentioned it as a last resort of closing institutions. But some of the institutions that have been particularly hard hit by falling enrollments, Mansfield, Edinburgh, Lock Haven, one of the things that strikes me about like those three schools in particular is they're located in rural areas. Is that a factor in those schools' problems?
So I think, you know, I think it certainly it is one of the factors in the it's one of the challenges that they face. Sure, they're in areas where the population, in particular the high school leaving population, is declining at a rate greater than it's declining across the state. So that definitely factors into it. I think price factors into it. I just think it is impossible to, you know, ignore the fact that in response to the sort of pattern of state funding, the choice that was left to the system was to increase tuition, which began to really undermine the distinctive advantage that the state system universities had historically held, which they offered a quality, you know, career-aligned kind of education at a substantial discount that was targeting a kind of lower middle-class marketplace of students. As that price differentiation begins to deteriorate, I think it really begins to hurt our universities. And reestablishing that differentiation and ensuring that our programming is completely up to date and resonates with the student demand are probably two of our greatest opportunities going forward.
But then there's Cheney. Cheney not located in a rural area, and Cheney is one of the state-owned universities that has had some financial difficulties, some other difficulties for a long time now. I think, and you could be able to tell me, but I, the student population, I think, at Cheney now is down to 4,000. So a traditional black university. What about Cheney? How can Cheney make a comeback?
So Cheney's down at about 500 or 600. I can get you the number.
Oh, really? I added a zero there. Okay.
Yeah, and that was a good first class. But no, it's the high watermark for Cheney was about 1,500.
Okay.
A few years ago. So what's interesting about Cheney is that Cheney, of course, has addressed this problem head on, and the alternative to closure, in my view, is just a fundamental restructuring of the operation, right? And that's what Cheney's pursuing. So what Cheney's doing is it recognizes that it serves a vitally important, historically important, frankly, niche market, which, you know, needs to be continued. And they recognize that it's likely to remain small in terms of its enrollments. So in terms of in order to support itself, it's pursuing a range of interesting private-public partnerships where partners from the commercial and not-for-profit sector come in and lease building and land, et cetera, and sort of conduct their business on campus, and at the same time provide internships for the students who are resident at Cheney. So it's a really interesting model. And the hope is that if they can generate 25 or 30% of their revenues through those partnerships, then they have the financial cushion to maintain a small enrollment and to sustain themselves financially. And it's that kind of creative thinking and restructuring and sort of innovation that's going to happen, have to happen, you know, across higher education generally, but also at more of our universities, not necessarily pursuing precisely the model that Cheney has pursued, but to be as creative and innovative in thinking about how to sustain going forward.
Let's get back to funding. State funding for Pennsylvania's 14 state-owned universities has been stagnant. Actually, it's only up to a level that it was 10 years ago when the first cuts were made during the Corbett administration. I know you were asking for an increase this year. The state is looking at a possible $4 billion budget deficit. All those things into consideration, what has to happen in your mind for the 14 state-owned universities?
Yeah, we got to put our foot down on the pedal. We got to go faster along the path that we were on. Look, we were on the right path. I'm convinced of that. It was a path which was going to accelerate progress towards a sort of sustaining model where we're, our expenditures and our revenues are aligned, a path where we were going to operate at maximum efficiency because of the shared services environment, but more exciting. A path that was going to enable us to think across the state about programmatically to ensure that students, irrespective of zip code, irrespective of the campus that they're actually enrolled in, have access to a full range of credentialing programs that they need in order to be socially mobile and to contribute to their communities.
But, okay, COVID-19 really created a huge barrier to a lot of those funding questions. Like, a lot of us are in a situation right now of we don't know what's going to happen. So, yeah. Best case scenario for you, for you, meaning the state-owned universities, PASHE, going forward with state funding.
The best case scenario.
Yeah.
The best case scenario probably comes out of the 2008, the Great Recession, where you saw for a period of years that the combination of federal stimulus funding and state funding, it was able to sustain public universities at about the level that they had been sustained till that time. And then a period of recovery after that as state budgets improved. That pattern did not fully play itself out here in the state. The state did not return to the, after the federal funding was exhausted, the state didn't return to the level that it had committed before. But it played out in many other states. That, to me, would be the best case scenario.
What about worst case scenario?
Worst case scenario is we have to be super creative, even more creative and energetic than we are already. But, you know, this is a public university. Our mission is public. And I've said it before. I'll say it here. You know, in the aftermath of this pandemic, people need higher education more than ever before. It is the most reliable pathway into a sustaining career. There are going to be a large number of under and unemployed Pennsylvanians who are going to need our help. And our obligation is to figure out how to meet those needs and to be as energetic and creative as we can in doing that and to partner with the state and the private sector as closely as we can in order that we can achieve that mission.
Dr. Greensteiner, is faculty still being paid at the 14 state-owned universities?
Faculty are working really hard at the 14
years. Oh, really? Really?
Our students are in remote, and we're still in term. And there's some great stories from the field about faculty doing all sorts of heroic stuff to ensure that their students are engaged and able to complete their programs. I've just marveled at it. I'm really in awe of our faculty and staff and what they have accomplished in the last several weeks. Yeah, it's an amazing story. It's there to be written someday.
What about when you're thinking about the finances and other aspects of the future of the state-owned universities? How often or what part, what percentage, and I know you can't give me a percentage, but how important is the role of the university in the community?
Oh, goodness me. I mean, it is vitally important. You know, it is in some cases the major, often the major employer. But beyond that, especially in rural communities, you know, rural communities rely on their universities to sort of train the business and healthcare professionals and community leaders that they need in order to sustain themselves. So it's been important in those, in the community, of course, in many places, our universities provide sort of cultural anchors for their communities. In urban areas, our universities provide the affordable pathway into sustaining professions. If anything, the kind of public, regional, comprehensive universities that we represent will become increasingly important going forward. That is my view. It's why it is, I think, our obligation to figure out creatively how to sustain them. And I think one of the challenges that we have is that people tend to think, listen to an argument about a conversation about closure and assume that the options are you either close a school or you continue operating it as is. And that is actually not the choice that we're looking at. The choice that we're looking at is how fundamentally to restructure a school so that it can continue to serve its historic mission, even if it is doing it in dramatically different ways.
Dr. Dan Greenstein is Chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. Dr. Greenstein, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
And you, Scott. Thanks so much. Stay safe.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll talk about the COVID-19 pandemic and the impact it has had on emergency responders. So be sure to tune in.